Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger Psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about attachment styles. Our guest is Dr. Leslie Becker Phelps, author of the Insecure in Love workbook. Leslie is an internationally published author, speaker, and psychologist. She's a trusted expert on relationship issues that people have with themselves as well as with others. She is author of Insecure in Love and Bouncing Back from Rejection. She writes the Making Change blog for www.psychologytoday.com. In addition, she has created a library of short videos on her YouTube channel to offer people the opportunity to learn how to feel better about themselves and their lives. Becker Phelps has a private practice in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, and is on the medical staff of Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital, Somerset, where she previously served as clinical director of Women's Psychological Services and chief of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry. She lives with her husband and two sons in Basking Ridge. Find out more about her at www.drbeckerphelps.com. Hi, Leslie. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Cassie. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I'm so fascinated by attachment styles in general, and I just have really loved your work in this area. And I was wondering if we could kick off by you just sort of telling me what draws you to write and speak about relationships and connection.
Absolutely. So I am first and primarily a psychologist. I do a lot of therapy. I think a lot about well-being, you know, emotional well-being, health, work with people to help them develop that. And what I have learned over the course of my education, training, research, work with people, is that ultimately, I think the biggest thing in helping people feel good, feel like whole, is and the sense of well-being is connection. When people can really fully connect with themselves and they can really fully connect with others in a way that's open and accepting and compassionate and empathic, they feel good. And so, you know, so central to connections is our personal relationships and, of course, our love relationships. You know, we get a little bit more intense with each step. And so that's what drives me to explore these areas.
Yeah, I think, like you said, there's just really nothing more powerful than that connection, and like that improves your entire well-being.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, it's one thing that's interesting to me is I've approached this area as a psychologist, so learning from that realm. Mm-hmm. But I've recently read some religious books, like from different traditions, and I can't tell you how often they come back to awareness and connection. And when you're more self-aware and you're more connected within yourself and with God, and it's part of spirituality, and it really seems like an extension of the same thing. So I find that fascinating. That's beyond my realm. Yet it's fascinating that it all still links back up.
It absolutely does. Like, if you think about anything we're all seeking, it's that connection, whether it is through that spirituality or through activity or groups or anything like that. It does really all come back to that.
Yeah, I agree. So.
In your book, you describe the human attachment system as central to love relationships. Can you talk about what this is and why that's so important?
Absolutely. As animals, we have a survival instinct, right? We have this drive to survive. And as humans, actually as mammals, part of that or essential to that is our wiring to connect with others. And more specifically, you're born into the world, you're going to connect with your caregiver. And so that's our initial connection, right? And with that wiring, then we get to try to get a sense of the other person so that we can feel safe with the person who's taking care of us. If all goes well and they are caring towards us and help us to feel okay and safe, even when we're distressed, our diaper's wet, we're hungry, whatever it is, if we're distressed, if they can help us feel calmed, then we are beginning to establish this positive sense of connection, a sense of you can rely on the other. And also a sense of you're okay, you feel good in you. So, right, even if you're crying and wailing or whatever it is you're doing as an infant, you can still feel good in you. And we build on that through our lives. And this is our attachment system. And so we carry, and I'm really shortening this a lot so we can talk more, mm-hmm. but basically we carry that initial sense of the other who's significant to us and our sense of ourselves. We build that throughout our lives and even into adulthood. We have that as central to what's going to help us feel good. So it's all the way back to our wiring for survival. Also, I would add in that central to that is not just you're surviving physically, but also so being safe physically, but also feeling safe emotionally. So within that process, we're learning to how we feel emotionally, how we regulate our emotions, how we can feel safe and help ourselves. So that's very much tied in.
For someone who is sort of coming to this without understanding attachment styles, what are some ways that they can sort of tune in and maybe figure out what their attachment style is?
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Technically, there are these four basic attachment styles, but I often think of it more in terms of, as I was saying before, your connection to yourself and your connection to the other, self and other. So there's something called your model of self. And the model of self is a range of experience from feeling lovable, worthy, having value, and the range of that from there all the way to feeling unlovable, like you have no worth, like you have no value. So your model of self is somewhere along that range. Then you have a model of others. And that is you seeing the other as emotionally supportive, emotionally available, and the range of that to all the way emotionally unavailable. And that could either be they're just not there, they're not able to be supportive, they're not capable, hostile towards you, you know, any of those, but it's that range. When you put those two things together, you come up with the four attachment styles. But if you just look at each one, someone who feels on that range of emotionally, how you feel towards yourself, if you feel lovable, right? So you have value, you're lovable, you feel secure in yourself. If you, at the other end of the range, if you feel like you don't have value, you're essentially flawed, you're deficient, there's something wrong with you, you are going to have a more anxious attachment style. So broadly speaking, you know, you can be more anxious. So, and then when you look at the model of others, if in the way you relate to others, when you think about significant others, if you would see them, if you have a tendency to see people as emotionally available and supportive, able to do that, then you would not avoid engagement. But if you think they're going to be rejecting or not capable of helping or hostile, anything like that, you're going to want to avoid those relationships. That would make you more in the realm of having an avoidant attachment style. So I think that that is probably the simplest way to think of attachment and those two broad spectrums.
Do you find that certain attachment styles are attracted to other attachment styles?
One of the most common dynamics that you see in relationships where there's relationship problems is the fear, the anxious and the avoidant kind of connecting. Mm-hmm. So you have the person who's, so when you're anxiously attached, so when you feel like you don't have value, boy, let me back up. So I said there's four attachment styles. So one of the attachment styles is called preoccupied. That person, they feel like they lack value. So like, I feel like there's something not okay about me. But I think others are emotionally available. So I think other people could be supportive and helpful. So while I feel maybe not capable of helping myself, I can turn to someone else and be like, oh, they can help me. And so I want to seek their love and their acceptance. That person, and a lot of people listening may relate to this. What happens is you feel like, yeah, other people could be supportive, but I don't know that they would want to support me or care about me because, you know, I don't feel like I have value. So now I need to earn the value. I'm going to be really, if I'm really, really nice, then they'll love me. If I earn a lot of money, they'll love me. If I, you know, if I get prestige, they'll love me. And so people become preoccupied with trying to get the love of the other person or the approval of the other person. We call that a preoccupied attachment style.
That has to be like earned.
You have to earn it, mm-hmm. right? So people are there, but then you tend to not feel good about you. So, you know, one version of that is you have someone who's very friendly and nice and caring. And those are wonderful traits. I don't want to say that's bad. However, if you're doing that to earn the attention of other people, acceptance of other people, what's happening is you're not feeling good about you. And you're taking yourself out of the picture like, oh, I'm not that important. I tend to send to other people. Then it's a problem. So for those people, they have a problem. And those people will sometimes connect with someone who's more avoidantly attached or what we would call dismissing. So they think, I have value, right? They think, oh, I have value, but I don't think I can rely on other people. So for those people, this is the dismissing attachment style. For those people, the way they feel, the way they get to feeling like they have value is they just don't pay attention to when they're distressed. So they just intellectually, they're like, I can do this. I can work on this. I can make this happen. If they are feeling hurt or scared or whatever, they can minimize it and they can dismiss those things. Also, they expect other people are not going to help them. So they're going to dismiss the other person. So now you have the dismissing person. And so they need to keep somebody at a distance, but even they need connection because it's wired in. When a dismissing person gets together with a preoccupied person, we have a dance that goes on. It's a pursuit withdrawal dance. So the first they love each other, like there's this, you know, fireworks or whatever, that's great. As things settle in, the person who is anxiously attached or who has the preoccupied style, they need reassurance. The dismissing person's like, that's a little bit too close. Thank you very much. So they step back. And then the anxious person, the preoccupied person, they step forward. And the dismissing person doesn't want to be that close. So they step, so they do that. And then finally, the anxious person, the preoccupied person says, oh, I'm never going to get this love. And so they back out. When they back up, the dismissing person steps forward. So we have this dance. And so then that goes round and round. So that is a very common relationship between two different attachment styles. What's interesting is that people who are securely attached, that means their model of self is they feel worthy. Their model of others is they think other people are emotionally available. So if they're upset, they're having a hard time, they can turn to themselves because they're worthy and they're capable and they can do this. And they can turn to someone else and they can get help. So that's going to make them very resilient, help them get through things. People who are securely attached, they being in a relationship with them can help anybody who has any of the other. There's only one type of attachment that's securely attached. There's actually three types that are insecurely attached. Being with someone who's securely attached can help any of the other three attachment styles. So that's, I think, helpful to know. Just so people know, because they may be wondering, so far I've only mentioned insecurely attached styles were the dismissing style, right? The person who just keeps people at a distance, the preoccupied style. The one that I haven't mentioned is a combination. This is a little confusing. Combination of the dismissing and the preoccupied. So these people feel like they need to get a sense of safety. Remember, this is all based on safety. They go to turn to themselves for safety, but you know what? They feel like they have no value. So they try to turn to themselves. That doesn't work. So then they try to turn to the other person, but they think the other person, model of others, they think the other person will not be available to them. So then they get upset. And so they go back and forth and it's all, and so these are people who have very chaotic relationships. It's very difficult. It's very distressing. And often people in these situations, it's very helpful for them to get therapy so they can kind of sort that out and find the ways to get stronger, both within themselves, feeling their own value, and also being able to find a way to connect with others and feel safe with others.
I want to ask, so you're talking about all these attachment styles. Is there a certain level of self-awareness that comes with each that you find? Like, are the three kind of insecure attachments less aware of where those feelings are coming from?
People who are securely attached are able to be self-aware. I was going to say without bias, we all have bias, but they're open to whatever struggles they have or whatever difficulties. They could be open. The self-awareness for people who are insecurely attached gets biased in the direction of wherever their insecurity is or wherever their difficulty is. So someone who is, if we just use the two basic attachment styles, the broad ones of anxiously attached or avoidantly attached. People who are anxiously attached, who feel like they don't have value or they feel deficient somehow, they're going to perceive the world in that way or themselves in the world in that way. So that affects their self-awareness. And then it also affects how they imagine other people see them. And people who have a more avoidant attachment style will be less self-aware because they don't, they'll be aware of what they do and their performance and their actions, but less internally aware because part of how they cope with distress is to just keep it at a distance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was just curious, just because of, you know, so much of mental health requires a self-awareness to tune into to what is going on. So I was just curious if how your attachment style would affect that.
Right, right. And self-awareness is absolutely central to what it is I talk about.
How does self-awareness help you to develop a more secure attachment?
When you develop self-awareness, then you can start to see yourself more clearly in the world. And then when you could see yourself more clearly in the world, you become more aware of your patterns. Hopefully what you can do is you can really get where you're coming from. You can not only intellectually see it, but you can understand emotionally what's going on. This opens you to empathy. Like, you could be empathic to your struggles. So now not only are you having your anxious attachment, you're having your insecurities, but you see them. You're able to have empathy for them. Then when you have empathy for them, hopefully you have a sense of caring towards yourself. So now we have compassion. And then with the compassion, that means wanting, feeling a pull towards helping yourself to ease your pain or your distress. And now with the awareness of what's going on and the desire and the more positive perspective on it, you could be encouraging yourself to take those steps forward to then become increasingly more secure. I call that as a whole, I would call that compassionate self-awareness. So again, you'll notice compassionate is just the adjective, it's just describing the type of self-awareness. And I think that that's a very important, very powerful agent of healing.
Is this one of the two ways that you find that people can earn that secure attachment, is that self-awareness?
Absolutely. So again, the way to think about all of what we're talking about, if we come back to attachment theory, it's about how you relate to yourself and how you relate to others. Always coming back to that. Mm-hmm. So in order to become more securely attached, you want to be able to relate to yourself more positively. That's the compassionate self-awareness. Then I would say you would want to have compassionate other awareness. So you can relate to others and see them as emotionally available. Just broadly speaking, obviously, if somebody's not emotionally available, you want to see that clearly. Mm-hmm. But it's just that when there are caring others, you want to be able to take that in. And so to develop a more secure attachment style, or to have healthier, happier relationships, feel greater wellness in your life, you develop greater connection, more positive connection with yourself through compassionate self-awareness, and then with others through the compassionate other awareness. If you have both of those pieces, you are going to feel a sense of acceptance, wellness, positivity.
Such a powerful promise too.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the chapters in your book is called Preparing to Heal. What is that about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's very important. Look, when all of us are in relationships, especially our intimate relationships, our closest ones, those are the ones that touch our heart the most, which means we are the most vulnerable. In those relationships, there is a greater possibility that you'll get emotionally involved, emotional upheaval, especially if it's one that you haven't established a real sense of safety with. Part of our, again, the attachment theory is based in this drive to survive. So that's, if you feel threatened, that's like a big deal. It's like relates back to the inability to survive in the world. When we feel distressed and we get stirred up on that level, what happens is the parts of our brains that are trying to think clearly, make sense of things, our prefrontal cortex, that is impaired. That part goes dim. If you were to look at it and under scans, that part goes dim as the emotional parts light up, like your limbic system, you know, it all lights up. So when you are in the throes of intense emotions, when you've lost the ability to think clearly, and I think most of us, if not all of us, have had those experiences, you know, if not during, at least after, you're like, oh yeah, I was out of my mind. I was not thinking clearly. Mm-hmm. In those moments, you may feel very distressed, but you are not so open to changing and to doing what you need to do to heal, because you just can't think about it. You're just swept up. You're enmeshed with the emotion. Preparing to heal means you need to learn these skills of coping to help calm yourself enough to then take the next steps forward. Stephen Porges is a researcher, does a lot of great work with polyvagal theory, So he puts it in that context. It's one way of thinking about it. But the idea is that when your nervous system is keyed up, when you're sympathetically aroused, how do you calm yourself? And I would go back to, again, self and others, right? Your model of self, model of others. So you want to learn to calm yourself within yourself. So learning how to, one, recognize, oh, I am starting to feel upset. Oh, wow, I'm really upset. Oh, I'm at the point where I can't think clearly. Lower down before you get to I can't think clearly, you learn to identify, oh, I need to help take care of myself. Then within yourself, you find ways to cope that are soothing, self-soothe. You take a hot shower, you take a bath, you listen to music, you go for a walk, you exercise, you meditate, whatever your thing is, you pray, whatever your thing is, those are things you can do to help yourself. But you also want to learn to find comfort in others, because that will move you towards a more secure attachment style. So with others, do you talk with a friend? Do you, maybe you're not up to talking with people, but you just go out in public so you're around people. That's a way. Pets, I would consider them others.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's maybe feel less threatened. So you can sit and you just pet your cat or your dog, or you engage with them. So those are coping. So you develop your coping within yourself, coping with others, to help calm your system. And then that's something that it's not like a one and done. There's skills that you have that you keep going that then can help you in day in or day out. Whenever you're feeling distressed, you can find ways to comfort yourself, to pull back so that you can kind of reorient and do the things you need to do to get on a track towards healing. So that's why I separated that out as preparing to heal, is that you could be in the right mindset and the right, well, I guess mindset and also body set, right? Mm-hmm. Your body is comforted enough, safe enough to move forward.
I think that's really interesting. And as you were talking about sort of that, how it's constantly, you constantly having to do this work, right? It's not just like suddenly I'm secure and I'm all good. I really experienced this a lot. I like to pride myself as being pretty independent, pretty securely attached. You know, I feel like I've worked on that, like getting more securely attached. But recently I went through a cancer treatment, and as an independent person, that was so challenging for me to relinquish literally all control, one, to like the doctors and treatment, but two, to my husband, who had to be my primary caretaker because it involved lots of medicines. It was affecting my body. So I can barely lift laundry still, you know, like, unfortunately I had to use a feeding tube. So my husband was literally feeding me, you know, through my tube. And so that was so challenging to work through as a person who feels really reliant on myself. And so that was like kind of a good practice in that, relying on others. And I found that in those moments, I was missing that piece of self-soothing, because I felt like I couldn't turn to anything that used to soothe me and my anxiety. And I would notice myself getting very activated and very, mm-hmm. very upset, because I was lacking that ability to self-regulate.
Right. So that's, you know, and those challenges that we face, and I am sorry to hear that you even had to go through that, because that's horrible. But those challenges in our life really are part of what helps us to grow and learn and encourage us, like you're saying, like, oh, wow, I need to find a way to feel safe and open to the caring from mm-hmm. others, and can make you a stronger person for that. As much as maybe initially, and I don't know about for you, but for a lot of people who are more self-reliant, that feels like, oh, that would be a weakness. Mm-hmm. And yet you can learn, when you learn to open up to it, actually it's a different kind of strength.
Yeah. I found myself apologizing a lot for like the things that were happening to me. And I was self-aware of that, and I shifted it. Instead of saying sorry to my husband for needing him to do something, I would, uh-huh. I would say, I appreciate you doing this for me, because he kept saying not to say sorry. And I'm like, it's really hard for me to not do that. So that like conscious shift in language, I think really helped a lot too. Because I think I was meaning to say I appreciate you, but instead I was apologizing.
That's great. What a great example. Thank you. It's like you were able to find the words, and that meant, I think, part of the shift had to be you opening up to it was okay to mm-hmm. be accepting of it, so then you could thank them. But you can't thank somebody for something that feels like it's not okay right. to take in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the things when I talk with people about like relationship skills and what you need for relationships, making gratitude, you know, gratefulness and compliments, both of them, a habit, mm-hmm. you know, so you can really be attending to actively in your relationship, ongoing, those positive things, and that nurtures that secure attachment mm-hmm. I'm talking about.
We'll be right back after this short break.
I'm Dr. Lindsay Gibson. Growing up with emotionally immature parents can affect their adult children in several ways. Most of all, it affects the child's ability to trust themselves as adults and to see themselves as people of value who have healthy entitlements to respect and their own individuality. So join me on this adventure of self-discovery. For more details, go to adultchildrencourse.com.
I know that especially like illness and whatnot can come between couples. Like it can be really alienating, but I have to say, like, I feel like we're stronger because of it, which, you know, I'll take as a silver lining of having to go through that. But for a fairly young marriage, like that was very intense very quickly.
I am sure. I'm absolutely sure. No, that's, and I'm so glad to hear that you were able to navigate it in that way, because it has that potential. Mm-hmm. It has the potential of breaking couples up and bringing them together.
Yeah.
And it's really the paths that individuals take.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get a little bit into the core of your book. You have chapters of the book that are organized according to an acronym that you use called STEAM. Can you mm-hmm. explain this and talk about each element a little bit?
Absolutely. STEAM is the domains of awareness. So again, the central to what I do is helping people develop greater awareness, self-awareness. So I talk about, so if you think about it, oh, okay, great. So I should be self-aware. But what does that mean? Because it's not very clear. STEAM helps you to really grab onto it. S is for sensations. What do I sense in my body? Physically, what are you sensing? So a tightening of your stomach, tightening of your chest, a sense of nausea, maybe energy going through your body. What do I sense in my body? That's S is for sensations. T is for thoughts. What are my thoughts? What are my thoughts about my thoughts? So just because you have a thought doesn't mean you have to believe it. So what do you think about your thought? And you could even have conflicting thoughts. E is for emotions. What are my emotions? How do I feel? And then what are my emotions about my emotions? So again, you could have an emotion, like you could feel afraid, and then maybe you're angry with yourself for feeling afraid. So you, and just like the thoughts, you can have conflicting emotions. So what are my emotions? A is for actions. What are my actions? What are my reactions? And then you can kind of look at how that's affecting yourself or others. And then the M is the one that's less clear. It's called mentalizing, which it's a very jargony word, but I use the word that was out there. I didn't create it. And what that is trying to really get where someone's coming from. If you understand what's happening in someone's mind or inside of them, their thoughts, their fears, their thoughts, feelings, fears, fantasies, frustrations, their experiences. If you really can understand it in your head and also in your heart, this isn't just an intellectual thing. So you can kind of connect with it. You say, do I really get where this person's coming from? And you can mentalize yourself. So that's the self-awareness. And do I really get where my partner's coming from? That's mentalizing the other person. When you mentalize, when you can really do that strongly, that is the base for being able to have empathy, because then you could really empathize with what they're saying. And that opens you up to compassion, having compassion for their experience. It opens you up to forgiveness, because if any close relationship, people are going to end up hurting each other in some ways, even if it's not on purpose, because it's just you're emotionally vulnerable. So forgiveness is very important in a relationship. So STEAM, now that's those are the areas of awareness, give you a guideline for how to think about any particular situation you're in and to expand your awareness of yourself and of your partner. And then that often naturally ends up with the compassion. That's why I call compassionate self-awareness. In truth, I'm shooting for self-acceptance. But since we're talking about anxieties and difficulties, we need compassion to get there. And then beyond self-acceptance, even we're shooting for, this brings us back to the beginning, connection. To really be fully connected, if we can do that with our compassionate self-awareness, compassionate other awareness, we could see our partner more fully and then engage in a more open way. So that's kind of and yes, that's the broad way of viewing it. And each chapter, I talk about the sensations chapter. How do you connect with your sensations or your thoughts or your emotions? And on it goes. Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah. I love that you said the thoughts about thoughts and the emotions about emotions, because one kind of joke, but a serious thing that I do is I feel anxious when I don't feel anxious. Like I'm anxious about not being anxious. Like what, why am I not on alert right now? Which is so silly. Like I'm aware of it, but it's like a real phenomenon in the brain.
So can I use that as an example?
Yeah, absolutely.
So for you, you know, so for what I suggest people do is as you become more aware of each of the domains, right? Sensations, thoughts, emotions, actions, the mentalizing is the pulling it all together. Mm-hmm. So you might say, what are my emotions? Oh, I'm anxious when I'm anxious or not anxious. I'm anxious when I'm not anxious. Wow. Okay. So what does that feel like in my body? Oh, I notice I have all this churning, whatever. And what are the thoughts that go with it? Now you start to get to know what you're thinking. What are the stories you tell yourself that perpetuate that? Right. And then you could be like, oh, wow. So what if I told myself this story? Oh, I see my emotions kind of shift. Or you start to play with it. Now you can more fully appreciate your experience. And it allows for, you know, we talk about people are familiar with meditation or mindfulness. It's this idea of being able to have perspective on your experience. That's what the STEAM model does. It gives you perspective. So now you can like explore different ways of viewing things and different ways of being because you're both feeling it and observing it. Both parts are important. Mm-hmm. So if you're just in the experience, in the thoughts or the emotions or the actions, whatever they are, if you're just in them, you're probably not going to be able to change because you're in it. You're too fused with it. If you totally step back, but you're not connected with the inner experience, you'll probably be judgmental from the outside. Or you're even if it's not harshly judgmental, you're going to be directing yourself in ways that don't connect. Mm-hmm. It's the bringing those together that enables the moving forward.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked a lot about that compassionate self-awareness. Once a person is more compassionately self-aware and compassionately more other aware, they're in a better position to find and nurture a loving relationship. How and you kind of go into dating and all that stuff. How can you get to know whether a date is like good partner material?
So good question. To begin with, you have to know what it is you want, which means you have to be self-aware. Mm-hmm. So that's good. The other thing is the compassionate other awareness. If you start to learn how to really read people and where they're coming from, you can at least begin to assess this other person. And now you're assessing the fit. Is the person a good fit for you? It helps to know first, what is it that you're looking for in a relationship? I do give some guidelines, things you might want to be looking for, but like somebody who's emotionally mature, and able to think about somebody else, be caring towards somebody else, be able to communicate effectively, someone who wants to be in a committed relationship. So there's just a lot of things. You want to figure out what do I want? And then how well is this meeting with what I want? And maybe, you know, if you are aware, you've gone through all the work and you're aware of not just what you want, but what you tend to get pulled towards that's not healthy, then you can look at the person. You could say, huh, is this really, am I connected to them because they're what I want? Or am I getting pulled into old patterns? Or how much of each? And you can begin to think it through.
You suggest that you should give a dud date another try. Why is that?
When you are insecure, when you have a lot of anxiety around relationships, a lot of times what's driving your relationships is this need for acceptance and so or caring. And so you that's where we talk about you having an anxious attachment style or feeling insecure. It creates this pull to really want the other person. And sometimes people confuse that anxiety they feel as love. Right? Now, early in a relationship, we all do that. There's that excitement and, ooh, they like me. Do they not like me? What do I feel?
The butterflies. Uh-huh.
The butterflies, right? So I'm not saying that's unhealthy. That's part of getting to know someone. But if that's equivalent for you of love, now we've got a problem because that means the not knowing is what's attractive to you. And those are people who often may get caught in that relationship dynamic I'd spoken about earlier, that a pursuit withdrawal or, you know, with somebody who's dismissing because they're always a step back. Step away from you, you're like, oh my gosh, oh, if only I can do this. Oh, if I, and so then you feel anxious, you feel insecure, you feel jealous, and you think like, oh, that's love. So your question, to get back to your question, why give the dud date an extra chance? Because you want to think about, do you really like them? Are they engaging? Is the thing that's missing anxiety? Is it really that you're not emotionally interested, or is it that you don't have anxiety because, gosh, they're safe, they're authentic, they're actually really there, there's no game around it. And so you're like, oh, there's no butterflies, no, you know, drama with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to give them another try and say, hey, well, is there something that's really is working for me? And it's just that the unhealthy stuff is what's missing.
Can you talk a little bit about the end of a relationship and how can you move on from that?
Sure. Well, the first thing is, I think you have to recognize when the relationship's not working. I'll tell you, I can't tell you how many times that people come to me and I'll talk with them in my office, and really what's happened is they have not been in a healthy relationship because they can't get out of the unhealthy ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they just stay in them and then say, why haven't I found somebody who's healthy? Well, because you have to not spend all of your time with the unhealthy ones. Mm-hmm. So that's important. Once you've determined, you know, I really think this is not healthy for me, that doesn't mean it's easy to walk away. You still have whatever history, you have your caring feelings, there's a lot that goes into it. But you have to realize that that's a decision you're making, that's a healthier decision for yourself. Be clear in yourself. Then you want to make sure you have support. So hopefully you've developed relationships outside of the intimate relationship. So with family or friends, to talk with them so you can feel their support. Figure out before you end it, like, it's likely to be very upsetting. How do you plan to go forward to make sure you have plans, whether it's with other people or things you're going to do for yourself? You want to invest in yourself, right? To help you feel strong. Remember the things that make you feel good about you and do more of them. And so you want to think about ending the relationship in terms of, what do I need to do to go through this process? It's not a moment in time. There's a process of helping yourself through. And that also includes grieving it. Yes, you're the one who's ending it, but it doesn't mean you're not sad.
Right.
So there's a lot that goes into it, but hopefully that covers a lot of it.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, I have a friend who had two sort of long-term relationships, and it wasn't until she was out of both of them, ending on their part, that she realized it was her anxious attachment, why she was drawn to those first two relationships. Mm-hmm. And only once she sort of became self-aware of that pattern that had started with those two relationships was she able to sort of get into, you know, a healthier relationship for her, where she wasn't constantly waiting for that person to leave her, basically.
Right. You know, what's great about this model, the STEAM model, it helps you become more self-aware in a very concrete way. And if you're uncomfortable, but you do the work to sit down and know what's going on with you, the wanting to be with somebody who's not healthy for you, you start to be aware of what the pull is. And it gets harder. It's that pull gets less powerful. I'm not saying it just automatically disappears, but it's less powerful when you're like, oh my gosh, I am really wanting to get it together with them because they keep backing up, but I don't know where they stand. Ooh, that doesn't feel good to know where they stand. Wait a second, what's going on that they are not giving, they're giving me mixed messages? Like, that's really not cool. Like, you start to question it, and it feels less real. And then that gives you that space to figure out what is better for you.
Exactly. And so much of your work, obviously, we've talked a lot about self-awareness. Why did you choose to focus on this more than on the skills to build a relationship? And why is it so important to nurture a relationship that we feel secure in?
My experience is, working with a lot of couples, and frankly, individuals, is that the struggles are in the connection within themselves, right? So many people just don't feel okay about themselves, or they're playing out some inner struggle. Mm-hmm. So if we can get to the point where we've kind of worked through some of those inner struggles, a lot of the relationship stuff almost takes care of itself. And whenever it doesn't take care of itself, you learn a few skills and you can do it. So those couples who come, who actually are more secure when I see them, I'm like, oh, well, why don't you do this exercise? Try this, do loving gestures, spend this amount of time together. They do it. They're like, oh, this is great. And we're all good. I'm like, it's not that hard to strengthen a relationship if you have two people who are fully there.
Yeah.
So that's why I focus on the self-awareness. And I think that's true in relationships, and that's true in relationships with others, and also the relationship within yourself. So I would say it applies even individually. We are driven to survive And central to survival is relationship. It's connection. It's connection. That is central, not just psychologically or emotionally. It's like a biological imperative to have a connection outside of ourselves. So that is central to well-being. And so that's why it's so important.
Literally the most important thing.
literally the most important thing. You know, and I'll come back to, you know, it's connecting with yourself, connecting with a significant other, connecting with family, connecting with society. If you have a spiritual bent, you know, connecting with God or nature or whatever, but it's the thread through it, connection.
Yeah. Leslie, that feels like a really good spot to stop unless you have any final thoughts for the listeners.
I have a YouTube channel and I do these like 3-4 minute videos and it's all these kinds of information. I just drop them in 3 or 4 minutes. And so if people are interested, I would love for you to get more help, more information that way.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
A step-by-step workbook to help you move past anxious attachment and feel more confident in your relationships. Has your romantic partner called you clingy, insecure, desperate, or jealous? If they go out with their friends, do you worry that they might be flirting or hooking up with someone else? Do you often worry that they're going to leave you? If you find yourself constantly on alert or anxious when it comes to your significant other, you may suffer from anxious attachment, a fear of abandonment that is often rooted in early childhood experiences. So how can you move past this anxiety before it hurts or even destroys your relationship? Based on the Self-Help Hit by Leslie Becker Phelps, the Insecure in Love workbook offers engaging activities, tips, and exercises to help you overcome attachment anxiety by developing compassionate self-awareness. You'll learn to recognize physical sensations, negative thoughts, distressing emotions, and unhealthy behavior patterns that underlie your insecurity and respond to them in a more nurturing way rather than beating yourself up. You'll also discover how insecurity can overwhelm or paralyze you, negatively affecting the relationship between you and your partner. Finally, you'll develop the skills needed to stop repeating old patterns of self-doubt, neediness, and possessiveness. If you suffer from anxious attachment, you probably know that you need to change, and yet you have remained stuck. But by developing compassionate self-awareness, you can finally free yourself from this cycle of self-sabotage so you can nurture a greater self-acceptance and cultivate secure, healthy, and lasting relationships. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For over 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Join the New Harbinger Clinicians Club, a free membership club exclusively for mental health professionals. Sign up today and you'll receive a special welcome gift, 35% off all professional books, free client resources, free ebooks throughout the year, access to private sales, a subscription to our Quick Tips for Therapists email program, and more. Visit newharbinger.com/clinicians-club for more information. Do you have an idea for another episode? Do you want to send us a message? Our email address is podcast@newharbinger.com. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast was edited by Jesse Fancushion. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope that you might share it with anyone who could benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.